Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hi, welcome to the NASCAR NBC podcast. I'm your host, Nate Ryan, talking today on the day after the Watkins Glen International race won by William Byron. One more race to go in the regular season, that at Daytona. And here to talk about all of it is our resident Hall of Famer, NASCAR and NBC analyst, Dale Jarrett. DJ, thanks for being here. We'll start with William Byron wins this race. It's his first on a road course. He's now got 9 victories. And he's got wins on super speedways, on a short track at Martinsville, intermediate tracks. Now he's got the road course. Pretty complete body of work for William Byron this early in his career. He's still only 25 years old. For you, I know you're a Hall of Famer, former Cup champion, but 32 victories, you actually never won on a road course. You had that pole at Watkins Glen, but never actually got the victory. So what do you think it means for a driver like William Byron to sort of fill out his resume and get that win on a road course?
Yeah, a huge win for William Byron and his team. And, you know, to think that this young man, I feel like that he should be older than 25, because I know, you know, he came in at such a young age. I guess at 19, you know, he was in a Cup car. And, you know, to see him round into the complete driver that he is now, it says a lot. That's probably the one thing that I wish that I would have been able to do is win on a road course, because I think that it completes your resume as a driver. And it was just phenomenal what William Byron was able to do. And again, as you pointed out, he's put the numbers up on every different type of track. And these numbers are only going to continue to add up. You know, I don't know that we're looking at a Jeff Gordon and Jimmy Johnson type numbers from Hendrick Motorsports. But he's certainly going to be someone that, if he can stay healthy and continue at this, there's no reason that he can't win 5 to 7 races each and every year. And you think about that over a career, then you're going to look at over 50 wins by the time that he's finished, well over that. And so, you know, he certainly has, in my mind, established himself as the favorite. Again, because of he's able to win at pretty much any type of track that's going to come up in the playoffs. So, again, just a great job to have that in your pocket, that the competitors know now that there isn't anywhere that you go that you can't put William Byron's name in the mix that he can possibly win the race.
That 5 to 7 victories number you cite there, DJ, is interesting, because when I've had Steve Wittard on the podcast, the last time William Byron won, we had him on after that, and Stevie cited a similar number. He felt like about 5 wins a year is about what he would expect right now from William Byron and his crew chief, Rudy Fugel, who obviously have been a phenomenal pairing together. So as I mentioned, William Byron doesn't turn 26 until after this season, but this is his 6th full season in the Cup Series. Won the Xfinity Series championship in 2017. And I think it's interesting, DJ, I was thinking back on this today. William Byron, it's well documented that he learned to race on iRacing. This is a guy who didn't get into a Legends car until he was 15. I don't think he got into a stock car until he was 16. And then 4 years later, he's winning the Xfinity Series championship in 2017. So now he's 25 and he's a Cup championship contender. But even though he learned to race on iRacing, he essentially has never stopped doing the iRacing. And Jeff Gordon talked about this after the race, where he said that.
But I do love his, you know, tenacity and just, you know, the way that he approaches every single weekend. And when you have a driver like that, that is saying, give me as much information as I possibly can, whether it's pit road or restart selection or you know, gear selection, what, you know, braking zones, all those things. Like William does, he gets in the sim. You know, it's about helping to develop our tools and make them better, as well as make himself better and the team better. And he's all in. And you know, I mean, you still have to have the other ingredients to go along with it. And I think that that's what's making them have a standout breakout, you know, type of year, because the effort they're putting in, as well as the tools that they have at their disposal.
And Byron said it right away in his interview with us right after he won the race. He said,
I did a lot of laps on iRacing this week. I got a new simulator at home. So
I know that's a little different for somebody of your generation, DJ, because it just, it seems so different, but it seems like this is the way young drivers hone their craft now. Not only does William Byron learn to race on iRacing, but he actually improves on iRacing as well.
Yeah, Nate, I was thinking yesterday as I was watching the race and then hearing his comments after that and then reading things that, as you pointed out, that Jeff Gordon was talking about. I think this is the kind of, in my mind, the first new age driver, if you will. We've heard about iRacing for a number of years and the drivers that are there and the ones that, you know, have participated over the years and are really good at that. But William Byron is the first to take it to an actual race car and racetrack and compete at the highest level in a short amount of time. As you pointed out, this all happened so very quickly for him to get in the Legends cars and then get into stock cars and then Hendrick Motorsports to hire him. And then he quickly wins the Xfinity Championship and now is going to be competing for a Cup Championship this year. So this is kind of opening the door, I think, for more opportunities there. You know, we had that wave back when Jeff Gordon was the first to come from kind of the open wheel ranks, if you will, that a lot of owners said, you know, this is what we have to have. So then it was Tony Stewart and Ryan Newman and that, you know, it goes on and on. Obviously, Larson, a big part of that, too, and a number of others. But I think this might be something that we're going to see more of. Now, you know, this type of talent that William Byron has and possesses and his willingness to work at his craft, which you have to do this day and time in particular, you've always had to do it. But, you know, it makes me smile to realize that this young man is working that hard, because too many get the opportunity and I'm not sure they put forth the effort that it takes, thinking that, okay, I made it this far just on talent. That's not going to get you to where you have to be this day and time. So, you know, I think we're seeing something new and it's kind of refreshing. Yeah, it's totally different than my era, but so many things are. But this is going to be interesting to follow.
It's totally different from your era, DJ, but in a way, I almost feel like he's a little bit of a throwback, because, and you touched on it, I mean, when we had the wave of younger drivers come in after Jeff Gordon and Tony Stewart, both of them started essentially when they were like five or six in go-karts. Yeah. And then that became the mantra that you got to get your kid in go-karts as soon as he's, you know, before he's able to walk, like get him in a car, get him driving, get him on racetracks. And now you have William Byron, who doesn't really start driving until he's essentially a teenager. Even though he's embraced this newfangled sort of era of sim racing and study all the data, it reminds me a little of, I mean, your generation, you didn't race a stock car until, how old were you? I mean, were you in your
20. 20s? Yeah, 20. 20 years
okay,
old.
So, yeah. So in a way, it's sort of an endorsement of, you can still do it that way if you're willing to put in the work and if you sort of have that God-given ability, that talent to be able to drive a race car.
Yeah, that's a great point, Nate, that you do that. And I think on the side of it too, you don't have to worry about William Byron being someone that maybe gets burnt out earlier because of that he started this at 5 or 6 years old. And I'm not saying that always happens, but, you know, I can think about, you know, young people starting baseball at 5 and 6 years old. And, you know, by the time they get through the ranks of going through high school and playing summer ball all the time, just constantly, and then their opportunity comes to either go to the majors or whether it's going to college and playing, then, you know, their careers are obviously shorter, but, you know, do they get burnt out to some extent? And you look at Brexton Bush and Keelan Harvick, you know, they're getting great opportunities to start when they're young, but will they continue that? You know, are they getting to be a kid? Which it seems that's what William Byron was able to do, and then figure these things out as he gets older and probably able to comprehend more of it at that point in time. So, you know, you can make an argument for both, certainly, but I really believe this will open some eyes to people that maybe felt like that because they didn't get the opportunity to start at 5 or 6 or 8 years old, you know, racing go-karts or some type of midget cars, that they can't get in the sport anymore. I think this shows that, yeah, there is an opportunity still there for you.
So obviously sim racing and all this data wasn't available in the 1970s when you were getting into race car driving, but when you started driving a stock car age 20 and you didn't have access to that, are there things that you were able to do to kind of bridge the gap from people who might've started ahead of you, drivers who had that leg up on number of laps or experience in years in the car? What were things that maybe you did then to kind of close that gap that might still be applicable to, say, a William Byron or somebody following that path who gets into racing a little bit late? What did you do and what maybe can people still do now?
Yeah, I think that in my case, I knew that I was late in getting started, even at that time, that there were people that were starting to drive at 14 and 15 years old, and which is along, as you pointed out, along the lines of what William Byron did here. So I felt like that I had to catch up in a way that I had to know the race cars. I didn't know how to work and build cars, but I learned how to do all of that. So I knew what made the cars work. The other thing that I had to do was take my race cars and to the racetrack and actually test as much as I possibly could. So, you know, my simulation was, you know, going to the track and, you know, looking at lap times, going by the feel of the car that I had. So, you know, you just do it in different ways. And now, you know, that way is that, you know, the good thing about iRacing, the experience that they can obviously get there is not a true sense in the ways that the way that I was doing it. I sometimes crashed my cars in trying to get better. And, you know, when you do it on iRacing, well, you just reboot and go on again, I assume, is the way that you do it. And it doesn't hurt nearly as much, whether it's your pocketbook or your feelings or you physically. So there's a lot to be said for that and learning to do it this way. But that's the way that I had to catch up. And then the other side of it was to just be a sponge, to be around Jack Ingram and Tommy Houston and Tommy Ellis and Sam Ard and all of the greats that I was able to grow up around as I got my racing career started, and just listen and take anything that they were willing to talk to me about. You know, Harry Gant was a big help, someone that I always listened to. So, you know, that was how I had to do things. And so I think you can still be that in getting that information, listening and watching. And of course now, you know, they have the data and the ability. I'm not going to say that I totally agree with the fact that in race, the teams can get what other drivers are doing and relay that information to their drivers. I'm never going to be a fan of that, but that information is there. And if you have that, you have to use it to your best advantage.
There's definitely some edges that drivers have that past generations did not. And speaking to being a sponge, obviously, William Byron clearly has had that, teamed with Jimmy Johnson at one point, now has Jeff Gordon as a mentor, driving his number, driving the number 24 and putting that in victory lane at Watkins Glen. I want to talk about the Glen a little bit, but before we move on from that, DJ, have you ever done iRacing or any sort
never.
Of?
Sim? Never. Okay. No.
No inclination?
Video games were not my thing, even doing and simulating and even different things that came along, you know, opportunities to get involved early on with the games that they were putting out there and stuff. I never was very good at it. So other than the game of golf, that's the only thing that I continue to do that I'm not very good at anymore. So, but other things, if I'm not good at it, I try to stay away from it.
I appreciate that perspective. Obviously it has helped William Byron, as I mentioned, first went on a road course and does it in an interesting way. It was interesting in that it was relatively new, DJ, for what we've seen from road courses recently, but not the last 2 weeks, because this was the second consecutive cup race on a road course and the second consecutive cup race with only one caution flag. First time since June of 1978, according to NASCAR Man RR on X/Twitter. The last time there were two consecutive cup races with one yellow flag was June of 1978, Riverside in Michigan. So over the last two races, Indianapolis Motor Speedway Road Course and Watkins Glen, there was a stretch of more than 3 hours of green flag running, the end of the Indy race and then the start of the Watkins Glen race. DJ, obviously a lot of this tied in the fact that NASCAR has gone away from yellow flags, having stage breaks, and then having yellow flag on road courses and at Chicago this year. I'm sure that's something they're going to be looking at. When Jeff Burton was on the podcast last week, he said that he likes this concept, but he thinks that NASCAR should look at it in the offseason and should see how fans reacted to it. Did it work out the way they intended? What's your take on yellows not being used at stage breaks this year on road courses? Has it worked?
Yeah, you know, I like the idea that NASCAR went away from stopping the race, making it a caution at the end of the stages. I felt like that it brought some strategy play in a lot more. I don't think we need to ever look at and think about stage breaks and the caution that comes with that as an opportunity to create more cautions. We know that bunching the field up does create that. But if that's the sole reason that we're looking at it, then we're looking at things the wrong way, in my opinion. In looking that there's not more cautions, I think that we have to look at a couple of things. Either the drivers are getting too good because of everything, the information that they have, and not spinning out and creating situations more, or the cars themselves have gotten so good that where last year, I know they talked about how bad the cars drove, and I've heard them say that a few times this year. But if nobody's spinning out, then these cars aren't driving so bad. And so I'm not asking, you know, I'm not looking and saying that we need to make changes there for more cautions. It's just interesting that when you get a difficult place like Watkins Glen in particular, that people aren't running into each other more. I mean, we saw some opportunities that, you know, a caution might have been thrown just for a spin, but, you know, the drivers were able to continue on. So, you know, you can't just throw a caution because you haven't had one. And there has to be a real reason for that. So we could go back to stopping it. But it, again, it totally takes away that opportunity to really create any strategies that someone might want to get off on something different and do that. I'm sure that NASCAR is going to take a look at this. I know that, you know, this was something the fans were asked about also, and their overwhelming choice was to go away from the stage breaks, just as they've done on the road courses this year. So maybe the fans will have a different opinion, and NASCAR will listen at that again. And it is something that certainly needs to be looked at, but again, not just for the situation of creating cautions.
Could be one of those, be careful what you wish for, but I wholeheartedly agree with you that, and I saw some of this on social yesterday, that it almost seems like people want cautions because, well, once they put double file restarts on road courses, that changed the game. And when you had a caution, it meant you would have more cautions. When I think of road course action, I'm not looking for guys running into each other constantly on restarts, but that's essentially what seems to be the argument for, well, maybe that's why they need to have more cautions, because it means it'll trigger more cautions, right? Yes. Like that to me, that doesn't really add up for me.
Yeah. Now, and let me add this. As I watched the race yesterday, and it made me think back to Indy last week a little bit too. But as I watched the drivers, turn one has become an area that they're using outside the runoff area there, or where the lack of a better term, the curbing that they just run across now and have all of this space. So you've got way more room instead of being able, that the ripple strips there need to become more prevalent, to where if you get on them, it upsets your car more. They're just strictly driving across there and not slowing down. The same way after they go through the inner loop and around, I don't know what the number of the corners, I think it's turn five now, but you know, they've got, hell, they've got 50, 60 yards of racing out there that they used to never have. So we're giving them opportunity. How do we expect, you know, anything to actually happen? Again, I'm not advocating needing cautions, but to make racing tighter for these drivers instead of just giving them wide open space that they can drive these cars so much, you know, the car's not going to get out of shape at that point. And I think the handling side of it goes away a lot by giving them all of this runoff area. And also, again, without knowing the exact numbers they went by, but the left-hander coming to the last corner, they have more runoff room there. So you're not inviting closer racing by allowing them to have all of this runoff area.
Well, I think that brings up, DJ, the argument over, should NASCAR maybe enforce track limits the way we see it done in Formula One, where Formula One says, if you go over this boundary, we're not going to count that lap. And it's led to a lot of controversies in recent years in Formula One. I believe IndyCar has done it as well. Like, they sometimes officiate areas of the track where if you can't put a wall there, should the sanctioning body or race controller, whoever, say, well, if you run there, we're going to consider that out of bounds. is that something NASCAR should even look at, or is that just pretty much unenforceable, especially like you said, on a track like Watkins Glen, where we're seeing the entire field swing out into an area of the track that they never used to race on before?
Yeah, you know, I know that NASCAR wants to stay out of the officiating business as much as they possibly can. But you know, just like coming up at Daytona this weekend, we have out of bounds as you speak. You know, when you play a golf course, you know, there are certain places that you have out of bounds. And so I think that makes you do things differently. And so I really believe that something, you know, I think it would be more, you know, lines put there and you incorporate that. You know, then you get into the problem is you get into the situation like they'll have this weekend, is someone forced down below that out of bounds line, you know, and advancing your position. So there's a lot to take into consideration, but the technology is there to make all of this work. You could even put, I'm sure with technology this day and time, it could be made much easier to where it's not just a call that you have to be visually watching that, that there could be something that triggered that. So I think that's something that has to be looked at. If you don't want to close that in and put a wall there to keep them from running way out there, which I understand that, because you don't want to tear the cars up, but you have to enforce something here to where, you know, that's just not wide open space that the drivers have to race on.
Going back to what you were saying about the car, because I think this was another part of this discussion, is the car almost too drivable? And that, you know, it's got the independent rear suspension. It's got like this sports car type platform, better braking, better turning. You know, two things that I seem to notice: a lot of drivers saying that everybody was kind of running the same lap times, and that's not going to engender a lot of passing, unfortunately. And then the wheel hop that we used to see, the mistakes drivers would make getting the corners, obviously with the independent rear suspension, the wheel hop's pretty much been eliminated. Is that something NASCAR should even look at, or is it something that even could be done? I mean, or is that just the car is what it is and they have to sort of learn to live with it?
Yeah, I think with the braking systems that are there now and with the independent rear suspension, I don't know that we're going to get into a wheel hop situation. I mean, you saw what happened in the Xfinity race on Saturday. It created who won the race on Saturday, basically. Sam Mayer got into a situation going into turn one where he started wheel hopping, and that got him into the car of Ty Gibbs and eventually, you know, won Sam Mayer the race. But that's not going to happen. The braking systems are so much better. They're so much bigger and better. It took away an advantage that some drivers had. And Chase Elliott was one of those that had figured out how to utilize the brakes better than others had. And that was a big advantage that he had when he won. It, you know, an advantage that he used to, that he figured out how to make. It wasn't an advantage that Hendrick Motorsports had. It was just how Chase figured out a way to drive and utilize it and make it his advantage. But, you know, you're not going to get into that situation here. I think there's one thing in my mind that this could help everywhere when we talk about short track racing and things that need to be done. It works right into the road courses also. And that's increasing the horsepower of these cars to where everybody's not running the same speed. Because if you up this horsepower, and we're not talking by a little bit whenever you're talking about doing this, you're talking about so much that it's going to make it to where the drivers really have to work the throttle, and you're going to be carrying more speed into these corners, and things are going to happen. It's going to change the way that they would have to drive these race cars. And you know, I don't know that I was an advocate before this, but in watching the last few short track races and road course races, I really believe this is something that is going to have to be implemented sooner than later. And the drivers have been talking about it for quite a while. I don't always believe the things that the drivers are asking for, but in this case, I do believe that it would help them and help the racing at a lot of places.
So that would mean, well, I think they're about like 650 horsepower right now, like up it by like 100 or 200, like get back up to like the 750, 800 range? Or
yeah, I think 800 would be a great number for this. Yes.
You mentioned Chase Elliott. I want to get to him in a second, DJ, because obviously he was the second biggest story of this race. But fastest race in Watkins Glen history for the NASCAR Cup Series, just under 2 hours. What do you think are the expectations for a Cup Series race? Because I've seen some people say on social that if the Cup race isn't 3 hours long, they feel like they're not getting their money's worth. Do you think that there's an ideal length for a Cup race, or a minimum that it has to be? Or can it be okay that, hey, if we run a road course race without stage break yellows and it's 2 hour ballpark, that's fine, because we know we're probably going to get a who knows how long this weekend at Daytona. Saturday night could be 3.5 hours for 400 miles. What's your take on ideal race lengths in Cup?
Yeah, I think that's the difficult thing to answer, Nate, is because each race is going to be there. I mean, you just think of times that we've had a lot of cautions at Watkins Glen and the race went over 3 hours and multiple overtimes to finish things out. So, but yesterday happened to be one of those that nothing was happening as far as to slow the pace of the race down. And, you know, you're going to have that at times. I mean, you know, it's no different than, you know, you have football and basketball games where you don't have as many fouls and penalties along the way that they move along quicker like that. Of course, they have breaks whenever you have a possession, you have the end of quarters and things like that. So I do think with the price of things that fans, that if they were only sitting there 2 hours, that's not exactly what they thought that they were paying for when they paid a nice price for a good ticket. And, you know, I think the weekend experience is great and probably still well worth the ticket, but they weren't expecting to be out of there that quickly and not seeing more. So do you look at making the race a little bit longer then? You know, the first couple of stages were pretty short there and you know, happened extremely quickly the way that things went. So maybe that's a consideration here, that if we want to look into that we just simply make the races at these places a few laps longer.
That's an interesting idea, because I think that a longer race might have given NASCAR a little bit more moments in the race. Not to say this race lacked for drama, but the most dramatic moment was what brought out the yellow, and that was Chase Elliott running out of fuel. Interesting, DJ, we heard on the broadcast that there was some miscommunication. Well, not really miscommunication between Chase Elliott and the team. The team told Chase Elliott he had this many laps on his reserve tank. And as it turned out, that was an error that the team made. Alan Gustafson, Chase Elliott's crew chief, was asked about this afterward. And he said,
"It's internal stuff. I'm not, you know, I mean, I'm not going to go over our internal struggles in the media. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to go over our internal stuff in the media, and I'm certainly not going to educate everybody else on the problem. So, well, I mean, look, you know, to win, you have to have very little margin, right? I mean, that's what winning is you're going to make sure you exploit everything to the highest percentile possible. So, anytime you're trying to push, you're cutting margins. So, that gets riskier and riskier.
During our broadcast, I thought Steve Wotart did a great job explaining this.
So, Marty, they said they had 3 laps from the switch. That seems like a tremendous amount of fuel.
So, Steve, Chase Elliott now down a lap. He'll have to race for the free pass. So let's go back to some radios that happened about 10 laps before they were scheduled to come to pit road. We'll take it when he says, "Hey, when I hit the switch, how many laps do I have?" Here's what Alan Gustafson and Chase Elliott said on the radio.
"Got about 10 more. We're going to run to the switch. It'll be on you. We have 3 laps on the switch. So you will pass me twice once you switch it."
So then Chase Elliott came on the radio, said, "I'm on the switch." Alan Gustafson said, "Fine. 2 more laps. You go by me."
"All right. You're going to pit this time. This time. We'll get you a drink."
"Butter. I'm on 2. I'm out of gas."
"I don't. Just come to us whenever you can. Getting wrong information."
So, Steve, help me understand, what could the wrong information be that Alan Gustafson is talking about?
Well, Marty, it's a lot to digest. So I think the best thing to do is explain to the fans exactly what is in the fueling system of a next-gen car. For that, we're going to go to our Toyota virtual car and take a look at the fuel system. The simple idea is you have a box full of fuel to get you back to pit road. Now, the misinformation, Marty, to the whole crux of this, has to be how far you can go. 3 laps at Watkins Glen is basically 2 gallons, just shy, 1.7 gallons of gas. There is zero chance that box holds that much fuel. Right. 3 laps at Charlotte, maybe. 3 laps of Richmond, maybe 4 laps. But at one of the largest racetracks we race at, as are most road courses, at north of 2 miles, 2.5 miles really, that has to be the misinformation. To think they could run 3 laps on the reserve, a simple miscommunication. We talk about pressure to make the playoffs, pressure of a season where you've lost your driver for a bunch of races. There are so many details these crew chiefs have to go through. Alan rarely makes a mistake, but this is a mistake by the 9 team.
What did you make, DJ, of this error by the number 9 team? And was it a result of Chase Elliott pretty much feeling as if, hey, I know I've got to win this race or Daytona to make the playoffs? Were he and Alan Gustafson, the whole number 9 team, maybe feeling the pressure a little bit?
I think there's a definite, you can put this on feeling the pressure. And I don't think this was the only race that that's happened to this driver and this team. Not being in this situation ever, probably, to where they came down to, you know, having to, because they usually have won by now. But they found themselves in a year that has been like no other for Chase Elliott, the driver, or for this race team. With circumstances that they've had to do things and look at things differently. And, you know, quite honestly, you know, they haven't had the speed. And the other thing that you look at, when you have your teammate, William Byron, running up front, being faster than you and qualifying by a lot and winning races on a regular basis, you know, that does add pressure. You can try to deflect that as much as you want, but when your teammates are beating you, that's worse than getting outrun by other manufacturers and other teams. And so I think that the pressure has had a lot to do with, they realized that, you know, coming to Watkins Glen, they had to win one of the two. The good thing is they still have an opportunity to make the playoffs. There's nothing in my mind that says that Chase Elliott can't go and win at Daytona on Saturday night. Yeah, you have to have a lot to go right. And most of the time you're trying to dodge things that can go wrong in this situation. But, you know, not having to worry about, you know, do we race for stage points? You know, where do we try to position ourselves? They don't have to worry about any of that. This is simply give Chase Elliott the best opportunity that we can to be up front in the latter stages of the race on Saturday night and let his talents take over from there. You know, take the fastest car that you can to that point. But I do, when it first started yesterday, I was blown away by the fact that I heard three laps. I didn't know that. Steve Letard, as you pointed out, did a magnificent job once again of educating all of us. The race fans that we have that are watching on NBC and USA, those of us that have been in the sport a long time, it was fascinating to see and hear all of that and understand it a lot better as to how these systems work. But I really thought when they pitted as early as they did the first time that they were kind of putting themselves in a box there that everything had to go perfectly. So it was like they were kind of throwing a Hail Mary right from the very beginning as early as they could.
Yeah, and that was another thing that Gustafson talked about, DJ, is that they left themselves no margin because they had to do this strategy to leapfrog by essentially undercutting the other leaders. They had to pit on lap 17, which was probably a lap or two earlier than everybody else. I think actually it was like three or four laps earlier than McDowell and Byron ended up pitting on. And it worked. Chase Elliott went from 13th to 6th by pitting early, but it put them right on that margin. And everybody wants to blame Gustafson. I understand the crew certainly is complicit, but I don't think it can be overlooked that the reason they were in this position was because Chase Elliott qualified 15th.
Right.
And, you know, to your point, when Byron and Larson are making the final round and you're the guy qualifying 15th, and Chase Elliott owned that. He said, I just put together a horrible lap. I mean, it wasn't just this moment. I mean, certainly that was what running out of gas ended his chances, but it started way before that. It started the day before in terms of lack of execution for the team and driver.
Yes, and we've seen this in a lot of weeks to where they haven't had the speed that they're accustomed to having and it haven't had the speed that their teammates have had. So, you know, exactly what is it? You know, where's this line of communication? I know, you know, we go back to early in the season with Chase's injury, missing time when everyone else was working on their cars and working with their drivers, you know, and we're seeing the same thing, you know, with his teammate and Alex Bowman with the races that he missed. Neither one of them have had the speed that we are used to seeing from these two drivers. So you have to understand that they got behind. And when you're behind trying to catch up, it makes you do things that you're first not comfortable in doing. And second, you haven't had to do these. So you're not really sure how to go about it. And when you're not used to being in that situation, you're not exactly sure of the timing of that. So I think a couple of things, it does sound like that maybe Alan was given some wrong information as to how far they could go that he relayed to Chase, and that's what they went off of. I understand him not wanting to discuss all of this. It does no good to discuss it. It was a mistake, and mistakes do happen in the sport, and you try to learn from that. But this certainly was costly, and I'll say costly in a way that it took away any chance that they had. I do not believe that they, as the rest of the field, didn't have anything for William Byron. I honestly believe they couldn't have got on any strategy that was going to put them in front of their teammate yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly saw that. Ty Gibbs, A.J. Allmendinger, Kyle Larson at one point. A lot of drivers seem to have really fast cars, but again, everybody seems to be running the same speed, and it's a track position game right now on road courses. And bring up a great point, DJ. I mean, this is Chase Elliott's eighth season in the Cup Series. He's never missed the playoffs, and he's never really been in this position, to your point, even though winless his first couple of years in Cup, but I don't think they were ever right on the cut line, certainly the way they have been this year, below the cut line so much. And this is new for Hendrick Motorsports. I mean, now we know with Alex Bowman, Chase Elliott, both of them aren't locked in. We know one of them at least isn't going to miss the playoffs. So that means two major sponsors here, Ally for Bowman, Napa for Chase. At least one, maybe both, doesn't make the playoffs. I've heard you kind of touch on this before. What kind of knock-on effects might that have for Hendrick Motorsports if they don't have these really big companies a part of the playoffs?
Yeah, you know, this is something that you don't want to see, because, you know, we value all of the sponsors in the sport that are willing to come in. And of course, they all understand when they come in, there are no guarantees when you come in. That's you have to perform at a high level with the intensity and how many good teams we have in the sport this day and time. You know, it's just not a given. And then you look at both. I think that maybe Hendrick Motorsports gets a little bit of a pass here from their sponsors, because they have performed over the years. You know, Alex Bowman and Chase have both won races over the last few years. They found themselves in the playoffs, Chase obviously winning the championship. So there are a lot of good things that have happened. I think that both, though, are given a little bit of a pass here because of the injuries that they had and had to be knocked out of or taken out of the car for a number of races. Alex Bowman, you can even look at the penalty that they got. Without that penalty, they're in a much better situation of possibly making it in on points. They at least have that opportunity they would have when they go to Daytona this week. But that's not the case. That, you know, they put themselves in this position. They've had ample opportunities to go run better and try to get a win or to gather more points, and neither have been able to do that. And again, I think it just shows you the value of teams and drivers being together for a full year as other teams and their drivers are working and experiencing and becoming better. So it's not a good look for Hendrick Motorsports, obviously, that their two biggest sponsors both possibly aren't going to be in the playoffs. One of them, for sure, as you pointed out, isn't going to be there. But again, I think that these sponsors understand the value of being in the sport, and they do understand that certain things are going to happen and the possibility of years like this happening are out there.
It's not over yet for Elliott or Bowman. Certainly Elliott. I mean, we've seen him, he's, you know, not a Daytona 500 winner, but we've seen him win at Talladega. We've seen him run really well at Daytona. Yet Elliott didn't really strike an air of confidence when he was asked about Daytona the day before Watkins Glen. He essentially described it as, well, if I go in there feeling I got to win, it's like walking into a casino in Vegas full of slot machines and picking out the one that's going to pay out if I put a quarter in.
Yeah.
What's your view of, I guess, his attitude looking at Daytona? Should he be more positive? Is there a way to be positive, or is it better just to be realistic, especially given that you look at Daytona's recent history, the Daytona 500 this year, certainly the cutoff race last year, it does seem like there's a lot of wreckage. There's a lot of attrition. It just seems like those are the way these races go right now.
I understand what Chase is saying. And you know, this has kind of been the way that he has handled situations over the years. So I'm not surprised to hear him speaking in this way. It is really hard for anyone that is sitting outside that cut line to be really, really positive, because you just don't know. He may be leading the race on the last lap on Saturday night and, you know, literally not get back to the start finish line. It's just hard to have a mentality that, hey, I feel really good about our chances. I think that probably internally he knows that he's going to have a car that will be capable of winning the race, but it's hard to exude that confidence in this particular race because of what history tells us and what we've seen recently. And I think if he wants to look at something that's more positive, he and Alex Bowman, in the last 13 Coke Zero 400, we've had 13 different winners. So neither one of them is named Chase Elliott or Alex Bowman. You know, that does give them some opportunity to do that. But there's a whole list of them lined up there, too, that's trying to do the same thing. And you know, you've got five former winners at Daytona that, you know, are sitting outside the playoffs right now. But I get where Chase is coming from. That has been the way that he has been. I appreciate him not changing and just saying, trying to get all pumped up about this. I know that if this should happen for him, that he's going to be extremely excited, and we'll see probably some emotion that maybe we haven't seen from Chase Elliott since he won the championship, if he's able to pull off this win Saturday night.
I know a lot of Chase Elliott fans would be happy to see the most popular driver showing those kinds of emotions, because I think you're right. This has obviously been the toughest season of his career. Beyond the cut line drama, DJ, I want to finish here. You mentioned that you think William Byron, probably the championship favorite right now. There's a lot of, I think, drama right now, too, around the regular season point standings and capacity for a lot of movement, like 6th through 10th. Playoff points involved there, but also the regular season title. Martin Truex Jr. is up 40 points on Denny Hamlin, roughly. But I think it's interesting, like Byron now leads on playoff points. So I think he's got a good chance now of finishing third in the regular season and getting the playoff point bonus from that. So Byron could still have the most playoff points leaving Daytona, regardless of if Truex or Hamlin wins the regular season title. So does that kind of bolster what you were saying earlier? Does it feels like Byron is maybe the championship favorite right now, given all that?
I think there's a couple of things. That certainly in getting, I believe it'll be 9 points for Byron if he ends up third, which it looks like he will. So that puts him at another level. And even if Truex goes on and looks like he's probably going to win the regular season championship, you know, that's going to, unless he goes and wins a couple of stages, which hasn't been something he's done a whole lot at Daytona himself.
No.
Then he's going to, you know, have the second most points there. But your point is that William Byron is going to probably have the most playoff points heading into the playoffs, which I believe shows that with what he's been able to do, not just with the race wins, but getting the stage wins, that this is something that's very valuable. He's going to continue to get stage wins, probably going to have at least one, if not a couple of race wins, just to continue to add to this. I believe that's why his path going to the championship four, it's going to be as good as anyone out there. And when you have that number of points, I believe that's why you put him on top. Yes, he doesn't have a championship like Martin Truex Jr., who will be, you know, probably one of the only one of the top three there that does have a championship as Denny tries to chase down that elusive championship for himself. So, but I think in what I look at, you have to look at Byron. Because you know, the first thing you have to do to be considered the favorite to win the championship is to get to the championship four. And his number of playoff points, I believe, puts him in that position to make him that favorite already.
So do you feel like right now it's Truex, Byron as favorite 1A, and then Hamlin? Would you put anybody else in that four? It feels like it's just been week to week. It kind of changes.
Yeah, it does. And it seems that way to me. And I think that Denny has to be put in there because, you know, as we talk about Byron being able to win anywhere now, we've seen that. Obviously, Martin Truex Jr. has been that person that has shown that he can win anywhere on any type of track other than maybe Daytona and Talladega. But he only has to deal with Talladega in the playoffs. And so then you look at, you know, who might that fourth person be? And I think that the obvious choice, I mean, this seems like that it's lining up as a Hendrick versus Gibbs possibility, and I'll put Larson. He has his moments, and then when they're good, they're great, and when they're not, they're terrible. So he'll just have to figure out how to navigate each of the three race rounds that he goes through, but he has to be my fourth driver that I would look at right now. I think this is going to be a tough playoff for the Fords as they try to move through this and see what they can do.
Certainly defending series champion Joey Logano, not something we've talked about much, but those four you mentioned, I think they're going to be tough and a lot to be watching for over the final 11 races, starting with the regular season finale from Daytona Saturday. Always appreciate you being on the NASCAR NBC podcast, DJ. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nate.
Our thanks again to Dale Jarrett for joining us on the NASCAR NBC podcast. Thanks to Motorsports Manager Emily Convoy for setting up the episode. You can watch the video episode of the podcast on the Motorsports on NBC YouTube channel. and also find more NASCAR America Motor Mouths content and highlights from across the racing spectrum that's on the Motorsports on NBC YouTube channel. Thanks as well to Dustin Long for providing the Alan Gustafson audio for this episode. As always, you can check out Dustin's excellent work at NBCSports.com/NASCAR. The NASCAR NBC podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts, and it's also now on Amazon Music as part of the NBC Sports Collection on Amazon Music. You can find all your favorite NBC Sports shows on Amazon Music. Just head to Amazon.com/NBC Sports. The NASCAR Cup and Xfinity Series will be at Daytona International Speedway Friday and Saturday. You can head to NBCSports.com/NASCAR for all the information and schedules on how and when to watch. That's at NBCSports.com/NASCAR. If you have any NASCAR NBC podcast feedback, you can send to me at Nate Ryan. Thanks again for listening to the NASCAR NBC podcast.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen, remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.